Molly Clark, here we are at Cal Poly State University. You have one of the coolest jobs. Tell us a little bit about your world.
Sure. So I'm director of Cal Poly Arts, which is the university presenter on campus. So basically my job is to oversee the organization, but my main job is to curate a performing arts season. So we put on 30 to 40 performances a year typically.
Wow.
In all sorts of genres. We try to cover as many of the performing arts disciplines as we can. So dance, Broadway, speakers, mm-hmm. all different genres of music.
How do you curate? How do you find the potential candidates? And do you have like a committee that you all kind of round robin?
I don't have a committee. I definitely listen to the feedback from the audience. I listen to the feedback from my colleagues here on staff, but also my colleagues around the country who do this sort of work.
It follows your referral network, right?
Oh, yeah. It's a very small world of us who present in the performing arts. And so we talk frequently. I would say the main way that I'm curating is I'm trying to experience as much performing arts as possible. So I'm going to festivals. I'm going to conferences. I am consuming as much sort of footage online of different musicians and artists. Of course, live in person is the best way to experience it. And then I've been doing this for a long time. So I have relationships with artists and relationships with agents that I really trust and can kind of brainstorm about what we think will resonate with our audience here. And every audience and every market is different.
So intuitively, it's twofold. You're on campus. It's a campus facility. So it follows deductive reasoning that you're presenting stuff for the students that would resonate with them.
Right.
But, you know, I'm old dog, and I come whenever I can to your performances from the community. So you have the duality, right?
Absolutely. You stated it perfectly. We are trying to find artists that resonate with our campus community, so not just the students, but our staff and faculty too. And I'm often looking for artists who are amenable to doing workshops. So what you see on stage is only a part of what happens with our artists here.
Oh, how cool.
Like, oftentimes we'll have them do a master class with students. So a dance company comes in and they will do a dance master class where students who are studying that can learn pieces of choreography and learn about the artistic inspiration for different companies. But then I also have to pay attention to what will resonate with our broader San Luis Obispo community. I mean, I would love for our entire audience to be comprised of students, but that's not the case. Depending on the genre, you know, I would say students comprise maybe anywhere from 5 to 20%, depending
on. Interesting.
Yes.
Do you have rush tickets that kids that are on a tight budget can still afford to come?
So we used to be on a rush model, but once I stepped into this position, we actually changed to having a majority of our performances have just a straight up discounted student ticket. So $15 tickets, heavily subsidized.
So that's one, like I paid $60 for a ticket. So the student might pay $15 for the same seat.
Exactly.
That's really cool.
Because I want the performances to be accessible to the students and to our whole community, in fact, and beyond the student discount, we also initiated a program called Passport to the Arts, and we're partnering with different organizations in the community that serve low-income and marginalized communities. So partnering with Housing Authority of SLO, for example, to distribute tickets to some performances for those audience members who typically would not be able to afford the performance. We want them to be able to have access. So.
But you get good response. I mean, I've been at performances that are just about sold out.
Yeah, and I say this like cautiously right now, but we've seen audiences return in a much more major way than we have over the past 2 years in recovering from the pandemic, which I'm so grateful and relieved. There are some audience members who just aren't returning after the pandemic. And so I think the last couple of years have really been an exercise in strategies of how to build new audiences, get more people into the fold, and build upon that momentum for seasons to come.
Like the symphony, do you have membership where people sign up an annual?
So we have subscriptions. So if you buy tickets for four or more shows a year, you get additional discounts, 10% off. But then we also have a VIP membership. So people who donate to support the sustainability of the organization, to support the programming, then get other benefits that go along with their tickets. And we found that to be really successful in fundraising. And it's absolutely necessary for us because I think many people probably don't know, but the majority of our shows are budgeted at a negative, even at sellout.
What role does financial viability of a performance play? Are you willing to bring somebody in, a group, even though you know it's kind of a niche one that's not going to be viral?
Yeah, I mean, financial viability does come into play, but it is not...
It's not necessarily a deal breaker.
No, it's not a deal breaker, and I wouldn't say that it's the main priority in how we curate a season. What you hope is throughout the entire season, you're going to have shows that do well and bring in some financial wins, and you plan for some that don't, and hopefully by the end of the season, you break even. And there are artists that we present that we may full well know are not known to our community, but that we feel that their artistic voice is so important that we want to introduce them to the community.
I know this is kind of amorphous, but is there a hierarchical process in your curation? You know, what would rise to the top in your response?
I'm looking at so many different things when we're looking at the season. I want to make sure that we have enough artistic disciplines represented. So, for example, I wouldn't do 20 out of our 35 performances were all jazz. We want to have that representation across the board. But I'm also looking at diversity in voices and the identities that our artists represent, the cultures that they represent. And so it's kind of this jigsaw puzzle of covering as many bases we can that way. And then just thinking about if we think there will be a draw from our audience here, and if there is an initial draw, is it worth sort of the outreach and the education to bring that artist here?
Hi, I'm Addie Yule, a journalism student here at Cal Poly. Just on that idea of curation, I was wondering, have you guys ever considered allowing Cal Poly students and people who don't already have like a branded name perform on the stage or get a chance to be exposed?
Yeah, I think we look for ways to have some integration of Cal Poly students with the artists that we bring. We've actually had with our jazz series last year, we brought a brilliant jazz singer, Alicia Olatuja, and she did a masterclass with the Vocal Jazz Ensemble, and she invited students on to the stage to perform
really cool.
with her that night. Now, not every artist is up for that. She's a very special artist, but when we have those opportunities, we certainly take them. Like, that makes an artist more appealing to me when they're willing to have those sort of collaborations. I'll say that we do have some artists that we bring that are not brand name, so to speak. They may be really, really well known within the context of their country or their particular discipline, but they're artists who are not necessarily a household name. And to me, that's exciting to be able to introduce our community to them.
Have you ever considered bringing in local slow bands? I know a lot were formed at Cal Poly or like are consisted of Cal Poly students, and they do like house shows. With that discounted ticket, like I feel like students would be really inclined to go see them at the PAC.
Yeah, I think I would consider it again in partnership with an artist that we're bringing because our mission is to bring in touring artists from all over the world, whereas local artists have other venues to be presented in that context. But I think we have a lot of success when we have those sort of collaborations that happen between local and the touring artist when they present themselves.
Yeah, totally. Very cool.
Talk to us for a moment about, in your mind when you're curating, how it would dovetail back to different disciplines on campus, academic.
So there are some very, I think, obvious connections. Like if you have a dance company that you want to connect them to dance students. But I also like to look for connections that are beyond sort of the fine arts disciplines. So this is an example from my past arts life when I was at UC San Diego doing a similar sort of job. But we had a dancer and choreographer by the name of Huang Yi, Taiwanese choreographer. And he had a project called Huang Yi and Kuka. And Kuka was this large industrial robot arm that he had programmed and choreographed an entire piece around this robot arm in relation on the stage. It was a huge undertaking, you know, to try to figure out how to like move this 2-ton robot onto wow. a proscenium stage. But one of the great things that we did with the choreographer was, instead of having him do a master class, we had him go visit the robotics lab on campus.
Oh, how cool.
And talk to students who were thinking about going into robotics, studying that. And it was a really interesting conversation that I think the artist got just as much out of it as the students did. For the students, they, you know, had been thinking about who their potential clients would be in their careers. They probably weren't thinking of a dance choreographer. And so to sort of hear his perspective of what he was looking for in a robot to choreograph with, and then them bouncing ideas off each other. So I think those experiences are really rich too, or having an artist go in. We had a group called Shaolin Jazz a couple of weeks ago. They do live score DJing over kung fu films.
Wow.
Super fun. And we had them talk to students at the Black Academic Excellence Center about sort of their career path and how they carved their way creatively to create this project that is now being presented. And from my perspective, artists have something to offer students of every major, because I think talking about creative process is part of all of our lives, no matter what you decide to pursue. And those moments sometimes are the most rich and valuable moments that we have during the residency, you know, even beyond what happens on stage.
Interesting. You're right in the midst of creating your itinerary for next coming up season.
Yes.
But looking back this past year, and I know this is a subjective bias, but what was your favorite performance?
Oh, gosh.
I know.
That's so...
Yeah, which is your favorite child?
I know. That's really what you're asking me. And that's, and even when we, you know, we announce our next season, I'll sort of feel the same way. Like, I won't know which one to recommend the most, because I really vouch for all of them. Maybe I'll point to something that's recent because it's sort of top of mind. So last week we had Taj Mahal, Blues Hall of Famer Taj Mahal, multi-Grammy Award winner. And I would have been sold on bringing Taj by himself because he's such a legend. But what really, really sold me was that he brought this artist by the name of Sona Jabarte, and she's a Gambian kora player. And there's a 60 Minutes about her. She's a huge advocate for women's education, education in Africa. But one of the most interesting things about her is the kora is typically passed along from male relative to male relative. And it's been that way for hundreds and hundreds of years. And her father was one of the first to break the tradition and teach his daughter how to play the kora. And now she is like the most well-known female and first kora virtuoso in the world.
Wow.
So this is like breaking, you know, 700 years of tradition. So to have her on stage was incredible. And to introduce the audience to her and have so many people come out of that performance and say, oh my gosh, I had no idea who she was, and I am completely blown away. Like, those are the moments that I live for. Like, when we can expose our audience to artists or to art that they've never experienced before, and they leave changed, they leave transformed after that performance. So that one has been a recent one that's been a favorite for me. But that's, I've enjoyed all of them, yeah, of course.
I knew that. Let's look forward. I'm going to come back and meet with you once you've created your new schedule.
Yes, but I'd love to.
But in the meantime, looking forward, is there one that you're most excited about?
For the rest of this season,
or
you mean?
Or that, fall coming up, and even jumping to next season.
I'm not allowed to talk about the next season yet.
Okay, but what do we have on the horizon in the near term?
On the horizon in the near term, in April, we have a really cool collective called Small Island Big Song. And it's a collective of indigenous artists from the Pacific Islander region who have come together in this performance that, you know, it has music, it has dance, it has media. There's a whole documentary that they created. But the whole project is about raising awareness about climate change and its effect on their seafaring cultures. And it's just such a unique project. I'm really, really looking forward to bringing them here and making some connections in the community as well. They'll be doing multiple workshops, and we'll try to make as many sort of academic connections on campus for them. But that's one that I'm particularly excited about, again, and sort of exposing our audience to the new.
I'm going to turn the table on you. Mm-hmm. Molly Clark, you go to college. What did you think you would wind up doing?
Oh, well, that's, so I've always been a huge music person, huge music nerd. So I've played cello my whole life. In a former life, I was also a hip hop, funk and soul DJ, if you can believe that. So the arts and music have always been my heart. I did not go to college for music because I knew I wasn't a good practice room person. And if you don't like spending time in a practice room, you probably shouldn't be a music major. So I continued to play cello on my own, but I actually studied journalism.
Oh, interesting.
In college, because I knew that I was a good writer, and, you know, the decisions that you make when you're mm-hmm. in your late teens and 20s, I said, oh, I'll do journalism. And that eventually...
Were you on the newspaper at San Diego State?
No, at that time I was at University of Wisconsin in Madison.
Oh my gosh. Yes. I love Madison.
Madison is such a great town. Yeah. Yep, that's where I grew up. It's a great town. I sort of went from journalism into marketing and then arts marketing and then arts programming and so on and so forth. So I've had the pleasure of being able to work at a number of esteemed arts and arts education institutions over the years, and really fortunate to be here in this role now. So I still feel like I'm getting my feet wet. It's been 2.5 years. My first year was when we first reopened after the pandemic. And so it's been a roller coaster of sorts, and I'm finally starting to feel grounded here with our audience.
That's really cool. So we're going to regroup part two, Molly Clark.
Yes.
In the near term future. In the meantime, where would somebody go to learn more about what happens here?
Best place to go is calpolyarts.org. You can find information on our outreach programs, about the events coming up. You can buy your tickets, and then you can also get signed up for notifications via email or on our social media accounts as well. And I would urge people to do that now, especially as we're sort of gearing up to announce our next season in the late spring, early summer. Then you'll be the first one to be notified.
Do you take a break in the summertime?
I find that we have no break. It's just a different pace. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So in the summer, we're really just ramping up. We're launching the next season. So a lot of it is around sort of the publicity of that. And then we're trying to prepare as much as we can, sort of the logistics of the fall. Because once that train starts running,
get out of the way.
Yeah, it doesn't stop.
Yeah.
My name is Molly Clark, and I'm the director of Cal Poly Arts.
Molly, thank you so much for the time. This has been really, literally illuminating.
Oh, thank you. I really, really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
My pleasure. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Cal Poly State University, San Luis Obispo.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, iTunes, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station. I listen to WNYC in New York, and in fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So yes, please support your local NPR station.
World Bicycle Relief partners with communities to deliver specially designed, locally assembled, rugged bicycles for people in need. Nearly 1 billion people in rural regions of the world live in communities far from the nearest paved road, walking miles every day just to survive. Distance is a barrier to attending school, receiving health care, delivering goods to market, and other critical services needed to thrive. Find out how you can help deliver rugged, dependable, life-changing bicycles to deserving communities. Log on to worldbicyclerelief.org to learn more.